coming up on this week's A Lively Experiment. With Super Tuesday over, it's now on to the general election. And locally, Senate leaders release a package of more than two dozen bills aimed at fortifying the healthcare system in Rhode Island.
A Lively Experiment is generously underwritten by...
Hi, I'm John Hazen-White, Jr. For over 30 years, A Lively Experiment has provided insight and analysis of the political issues that face Rhode Islanders. I'm a proud supporter of this great program and Rhode Island PBS.
Joining us on the panel, attorney and former Cranston mayor Alan Fung, Brown University political science professor Wendy Schiller, and Bill Lynch, the former chairman of and current advisor to the Rhode Island Democratic Party. Hello and welcome to this week's Lively. I'm Jim Hummel. Super Tuesday left millions of Americans with the reality of what we all probably knew was coming this fall, Trump-Biden, the rematch. On Thursday evening, President Biden spent more than an hour during his State of the Union address touting his accomplishments, outlining his vision for the future, and dodging some of the issues that polls say many Americans are most concerned about. Wendy, I was following you live tweeting. This ran about 65 minutes. I could have heard a little bit more about inflation. I know he wants to stay away from it. I'm sorry, I feel your pain. And I think that's one issue that a lot of people would have liked to hear more about, the prices in the stores.
Well, he did talk about shrinkflation, and he blamed sort of food companies for putting less, you know, fewer chips in bags, and people would notice. But what he's counting on are betting on is that inflation continues to go down. It's still there, but it's way less than it's been. And so they're counting on the summer showing that it's fairly steady and people are starting to get used to it and basically not as, you know, concerned about it as they are right now. So that's why I think he really, this was a pitch to his own base to remind them that he's with them, that he's on their side, and that he presents a stark contrast to a Trump candidacy.
Look, that was the most partisan State of the Union speech that I've heard in my lifetime. You know, how many references, even though he didn't mention by name to the former president, how many times did he, you know, just really go in on the platform? And it took, I think we were chatting about it beforehand, like almost 20 minutes before he finally got into saying, hey, the State of the Union is, you know, good. So this is one where right now it was his night to deliver in a fiery way to show his base that, you know, I'm ready for this. I'm going to tackle. I think, you know, Wendy and I were chatting a little bit before where he even made a subtle overture that, you know, Kamala is going to be my vice president for this.
Yeah, kind of slid that in there.
Slid that in there. So, you know, look, it wasn't your typical State of the Union. It was his political speech to his base, to his dynamics. And you can even see it afterwards where he just stayed and just shook hands with many of the members of Congress that were there.
You think Jill took another Uber back? She said, I'm not going to wait this long to go back to the White House.
Well, I'm a lot older than Alan, but this was the best State of the Union that I've seen in my lifetime. And I think that the president did just what he needed to do. Wendy and I talked about this a little bit earlier in that, and sure, it was partisan, and that's what people wanted. And people now, I think, are going to get more engaged. I mean, Super Tuesday wasn't really very super, right? I mean, everybody has known that it was going to come down to President Biden and Donald Trump. So the primary process, I just found, didn't really engage people that much. There wasn't really that much interest in it because it was kind of a foregone conclusion. So finally, you know, it's sort of like now we have the two heavyweights, the preliminary fights are behind them, and now we see what happens going forward. And I think that President Biden, I think, sent that message very clearly in his State of the Union and drew some distinctions, which is what I think any election should be about. I think there's going to be a real clear line of demarcation between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, and people are going to make a decision having seen that and as that develops over the next few months. And that's what it should be about. Obviously, I think that the president is going to get reelected, but at least there won't be any confusion between Joe Biden and Donald Trump as to who stands where.
We should have had a camera in the green room. We're talking about, well, I was talking with Wendy before, some of the best discussions. I try to not get them to peak before we come out on the set. Wendy, you mentioned it earlier. And as I listened to the speech last night, I thought he's talking more to Democrats than he is to the independents that he needs to bring in. And maybe that comes a little bit further down the line because there have been fractures with the progressive end of the party.
Yeah, there was no question that he needed to get his people to come home, and starting with the symbolic nature of members of Congress. He needed to get the progressive wing, the senior African-American members, a lot of people in the caucus, Democratic caucus, who haven't been out there for him, and lots of dissent, you know, could it be Biden, should it be Biden? You know, the New York Times, if they run one more article saying, oh, it can't be Biden, I think he was there last night to say, I'm still your guy, and I can do this, and you need to get behind me because I share your values, and I'm going to take the fight to Donald Trump, and nobody else is going to do it better than I can. And that is what he needed to do. I think he did that well. I don't think this appealed necessarily to independents in any significant way. I don't think it persuaded independents. I think independents are waiting to see which Donald Trump emerges for the next couple of months and over the summer to figure out whether things have changed at all, or is he the same guy that they voted against in 2020?
But they're also looking at, as I listen to it, I would have liked to hear a little bit more about inflation. And the border, I think, rings hollow. Right. I think everybody thinks, a little too late, where were you 2 years ago? And I think even some Democrats would admit that.
Yeah, and you're seeing it, you know, that policy impact that isn't just at the border anymore. It's coming into here in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New York, you know, a lot of places that are thousands of miles away from the border.
And heavily Democratic strongholds.
Absolutely. And when you have some Democratic mayors, including progressive Democratic mayors, saying, whoa, this is having a detrimental impact on my city, that's a real issue that is going to have to be addressed during this cycle, during the elections, because people vote based upon what they can realize and what they see and how they're impacted in their daily lives. And in those urban core areas, Wendy's right. Look, yesterday's topics was focused on the base and solidifying that base. But the majority of the people are going to vote based upon their pocketbooks, the inflation issue you talk about, the impacts in their backyards, in their communities. And that's where, over the course of this next several months, he's going to have to talk about, because his opponent is out there talking about these issues in a monumental way, whether it's in person or on, you know, social media.
What does he have to do between now and November?
So I think he's got to do just what he started to do last night, which is to draw distinctions and remind people what the differences are between him and what he's accomplished and what he will do with four more years versus Donald Trump, who was there for 4 years. You know, it's easy leading up until now, but now we finally have a chance, I think, and we'll see it over the next several months, where the two of them are able to make it very clear where they stand on these various issues. Inflation was 9%. It's down to 3%. It's still too high. Everybody feels
it. And prices are never going lower.
But things are changing. You know, the GNP is up. He's created more jobs. Donald Trump, I think, is the first president to lose jobs in 4 years since Herbert Hoover. These things are going to be discussed a lot over the next few months. And the board is a perfect example. The border's a mess. Nobody's saying it isn't. But for the first time since Ted Kennedy and John McCain put legislation forward 40-plus years ago that didn't pass, we had a chance to make some changes at the border, maybe not fix everything, but it was a significant step in the right direction. By the way, orchestrated by a lot of the most conservative members of the Republican Party in the United States Senate, until Donald Trump got on the phone and said, don't pass this, it hurts my chances in the election. And the same people that wrote the bill walked away from it. So those are things people are going to hear about over the next several months in this country, and I think it makes a big difference.
What about that, Alan? Do people see through that, the Republicans are going to just, I think they're with Trump, but if you go for the people who are on the fence or maybe sitting out, particularly on immigration, what do the Republicans have to do?
Look, bottom line, this is the dysfunction that's going on, not just in Congress, but, you know, in a lot of the state houses across the country, even frustration that people are feeling in government in general. It's because of the dynamics that are going on right now, where it's not about compromise, working together, get things done, whether it's on the border or anything else. People are frustrated at government, period. You see that, and that's generational. A lot of it, I grew up in that era of, let's get things done. It might not be the perfect bill, but it's something where we have to work together to kind of address some of these issues in incremental ways to achieve towards our goal. From the Republican Party, they need to get things accomplished. They need to address fundamentally, whether it's the border, more inflation, put more of the platform
out
there.
What did you do as opposed to just criticizing?
Correct, as opposed to just criticizing, because people want to see initiatives. progress towards these initiatives. Right now, what's happening down in Washington, D.C., and we're seeing it, is it's become more about fundraising, whether it's passing a bill or killing a bill. And what, you know, the
you know
what's
something
in those
about
bills,
that? You know a little bit about fundraising?
I've gone through too much of it. But you see it right now, even post last night, whether it's Republicans, Democrats, they're using clips of it to put on social media to fundraise. It's become too much about that instead of getting things done. You know, as a Republican, you're going to have to put more initiatives forward, not just talk about it, but, you know, put them on pen to paper and try to get these things passed.
Well, we're going to see ads going in late summer and early fall that will show people in cages. That's what the Biden administration is going to do. They're going to say, we've done these measures, but if you want to go back to a guy who puts people in cages, you know, that Trump's your guy. I think that's an exaggeration of the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, but it was also true that that was the policy. The other thing is about, you know, the visuals. I think the Democrats suffer also now because a Democratic governor in New York State has now put the National Guard and the state police in New York City subways. I grew up on Long Island outside of New York City. I saw police. I never saw, you know, you'll see people with machine guns in the major train stations. But nonetheless, that is not something people are used to. And that's, even though it's supposed to quell crime, it makes people believe there's more crime and makes people more nervous. And the Republicans are blaming migrants, which I think is stereotypical. But you also have people who are fleeing traumatic, violent societies. That's why they're coming here, because there's chaos and violence where they live. And they come to a new country, they're released, they have no idea how to function. And there's just a big disconnect between transitioning people coming from that society to our society. So Democrats have to do a better job of explaining and do a better job of transitioning people if they're going to catch and release. They have to make sure people can function in the United States.
One of the things we were talking about, another thing we were talking about in the green room before we came out, we touched on this a little bit last week, is where Gen Z and the millennials were. And they came out big time for Biden. A lot of people who voted in the 2012 election, Bill, sat out in 2016. I was one of them, didn't vote for Trump or Clinton. And I know there's some people who are worried about that maybe happening again. Doesn't Biden have to reel in that younger vote that helped put him over the top to be successful again in 24?
Well, that's the first time I've heard you you refer to yourself as a Generation Z, by the way.
Not me. If I said that, no, I'm a right in the boomer, baby. I'm a boomer.
Look, I think Joe Biden has to reach out to everybody, and certainly, no question, younger people have to be energized. That's what this campaign's going to be about. So it's our job, everybody, certainly on the Democratic side, to try to see that that happens across the country. Because, yeah, if that doesn't happen, there are going to be problems. The election's going to be very close anyway. I don't think anybody thinks this is going to be, at least I don't think it's going to be a runaway either way. I think that the way things break down electorally, that it's going to come down to four or five states again. Everybody's going to be on the edge of their seat watching those states. And small numbers are going to make a difference. So absolutely. I mean, if people stay home, that's always been a big issue with me. When people, after a primary process, say, well, you know, my person didn't get through, and therefore, you know, well, I don't really care, or I'm gonna show my, you know, unhappiness by not voting, which is basically a vote for the other man or woman, and that's what happens. It's happened before, so I think Biden and the Democratic National Committee are acutely aware of that and are going to do everything they can to make sure that doesn't happen.
Just before we go on to local issues, we would be remiss. You follow national House and Senate this year. What are you thinking about?
The House is completely up for grabs. You know, the Democrats are competitive in California for some of the seats they lost in 2022 to Republicans. And that's why Kathy Hochul in New York State is being so aggressive on crime, because that's how they lost a couple of seats in New York State. I think it comes down to 8 seats across the country. It's really a small band, but I think that is completely up for grabs. The Senate looks like it'll go Republican right now, but there's
just
some,
based on who's up and the demographics.
Who's up and the number of seats. And they've done pretty well in getting, quote unquote, reasonable people as nominees. I think Carrie Lake, we could have a debate about that in Arizona. But unlike 2022, you're getting a lot of experienced politicians who are vying for the Republican nomination. But I think, you know, there's a shout out to Bob Casey of Pennsylvania last night by the president. That's on purpose. He's running for reelection. There are a lot of swing state Senate races, which actually help both Trump and Biden to bring out more voters.
Quickly, your thought about House and Senate?
You know, I agree. I think, you know, the Republicans have a very good shot at the Senate. House is going to be a toss-up, but we also have to, you know, make sure we have sound candidates. The fact that I just saw yesterday that George Santos filed his papers again.
What was he doing in the chamber last night?
I'm like, give me a break. What is going on here? You know, look, we've got to change our image, you know, within the Republican Party, make sure we get sound candidates that are willing to do the right thing for our country and put those priorities first.
Okay. The leadership of the Rhode Island Senate released a package of many bills over the course of this week aimed at health care. Been a big issue. The governor talked a little bit about this in his budget. Bill, this is a nice concept. The House usually generates bills that have a price tag to them. So you got to get them on board. But I think it's a good step in the right direction. You know, reimbursement for doctors, paying off medical debt. There's some stuff that sounds good. The question is the price tag, I think, as it always
so,
is.
So I think there's two things going on which are very encouraging at the State House. One is you've got the Senate now that has sort of taken the lead on this package of bills on health-related issues, which is long overdue in Rhode Island.
And I think 20 years overdue.
I think it's designed to start a real in-depth, serious conversation about making some changes, because we hear complaints all the time about doctors leaving Rhode Island, lack of nurses, issues that really affect, as Alan said, people in their day-to-day lives. The second thing is, on the House side, you've got yesterday the Speaker released a whole series of bills again to further address the housing issues that we have in Rhode Island, which he's been a leader on, starting last year with 15 bills. There's now 30 bills, I think it is, that's been suggested by the leadership in the House. So I think what'll happen is the good thing I think that we have going right now is that the Speaker and the Senate President, the leadership on both sides, are getting along and working closely together on these issues so we can try to come up with compromises that will actually see legislation get passed and make a difference for people. So I think on both those issues, one emanating from the House on housing and the health-related issues from the Senate, I think between now and June, you're going to see a lot of work get done to see that some of those bills get passed because they make a difference for people.
Wendy, what about the health care packages?
I mean, I think reimbursement rates, if you talk to any doctors, I mean, it's the single most important element of why it's hard to be a doctor in Rhode Island. And they have to find a way to up those reimbursement rates and make sure that you can actually come to Rhode Island. We're always touting how great a place it is to live, but if you know that you can make more money in Massachusetts, then why wouldn't you live there? So, you know, you don't want any brain drain. You know, I think the Brown Medical School is making a lot of improvements. You know, you have the opportunity. There's really good health care in Rhode Island to beef up that system and attract people, actually, you know, from Eastern Connecticut, for example, or Southern Massachusetts, who don't want to go into Boston to get their health care.
All I can say on the health care issue, it's about time. This is a crisis that has been waiting to happen, and it is happening. We're in it right now. For anyone that's good luck trying to find a primary care doctor, you know, because one of the stress points is definitely, you know, the reimbursement rates, getting the payments compared to just, you know, Massachusetts and Connecticut right over the border. You know, my wife lives it every single day at, you know, Rhode Island Hospital, and she sees, you know, what's going on in that.
Not she just works at the as hospital, a PT at the hospital.
At the hospital, right. And she sees the impact every single day, not on just that hospital setting, but the entire healthcare system, especially what some of the bills that will help. You know, when you're talking about trying to make sure that the next generation stays here, having some type of program where some of their loans are either forgiven or some, you know, additional dollars to help them out so you're getting younger doctors to come focus practice in here, that's a great thing because we need that next generation of medical professionals that are staying here. But we've got to do more, especially on that reimbursement rate, because that's a big driver of what's going on. And we can't afford to have more healthcare professionals fleeing, you know, into Massachusetts, Connecticut, or anywhere else.
And buying up the medical debt, too.
Well, not only that, I think one of the other issues that's below the surface and doesn't get as much discussion is the cost that these young men and women face now to become doctors and MDs. You know, by the time they get through college and then medical school, they're suffering, it's suffocating basically by a lot of these young doctors with the cost that they had to incur to get there. So I think that's why I'm happy to see there's been a lot of resistance. Alan hates when I say this, but there's been a lot of resistance from the Republican side in Washington to do something about forgiving and getting rid of some of these college and professional school debt that these people have so that they can maybe make it a little bit easier. You hear the stories all the time in Rhode Island that I love it here, I went to Brown, I'd love to stay here, but my college and medical school debts are so significant
Go ahead.
Let me just push back a little because, you know, I think, you know, Bill's wearing too much of his Democratic hat here because the Republican mantra is this. You know, look, give credits, deferments, whatever you can to help keep these kids here in Rhode Island and do it the right way, not just outright forgiveness. And we're not talking about just medical, legal, whatever, grad school debt. You know, in general, there's got to be other mechanisms to outright just forgiving debt, you know, because there's that's the policy debate. Well, it's going
targeted,
in Washington, D.C.
To targeted. Hook to keep people here.
Correct. Especially in those areas of need, like what I, you know, talked about, primary care physicians or some other, you know, physicians that we need here in Rhode Island. But you can't just be a one size fits all, just forgive billions of dollars of debt across the country. That's not, you know, a healthy.
But if,
you know,
we had you, if we had you in Washington, we'd be able to talk to you about getting something
absolutely
done.
Absolutely. But, you know,
the problem with the Republican Party in Washington nationally is they don't want to hear it. They don't want to do anything about doing anything with these incredibly large college debts. The president has done it. Now he's done it, you know, it's being contested, but he's done
it twice. But it's being contested
how
he does it.
That's right, but at least we've done it.
Well, it would be nice to legislate rather than do executive.
I mean, I think the most important messaging that's been lost in this whole student loan forgiveness is that the president has, and this started with Obama, actually, and even in the Trump administration, there was stalling on it, but some of it still happened. More of it's happening now, which is people who took out loans to go to trade schools, these two-year professional schools, trade schools, or these online places, and then they close. They show up to go to school, and they're closed, and they've lost that $5,000 they took out or that $10,000 they took out that they have to pay back with interest, and they get no education for it. That's the bulk of what's been forgiven. And the second thing is if you go into a public interest profession, so if you're nursing and you're making less money, you can apply for federal loan forgiveness that cuts some of your loans. The third thing I would suggest is many years ago, you were allowed to deduct the interest on your student loans.
Correct.
And the Democrats and the Republicans took that away.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's something you could put back that I think a lot of people would think was more fair than outright forgiving loans just for college students. So right now it's messaging on the part of the administration. They're not really explaining who they're forgiving. But second, I think there's an argument to be made about who should get their loans forgiven and who might get a tax break for the interest as opposed to having the whole thing forgiven. So I think that's something that affects, you know, less than 40% of America goes to college. So that's the other issue,
all right,
too.
We do have to talk about the Washington Bridge, but let's do this. Let's do outrageous and or kudos first. Alan, let's begin with you.
I got two kudos. Actually, we're coming into tournament time. I want to give a shout out to my alma maters, Classical High School, the men's basketball team just won their state title. And also, right, Rhode Island College women's basketball. Jenna Cosgrove is doing a fantastic
undefeated
job. Undefeated.
Yeah, they look good. Billy, what do you got?
I got to take one of my last shots at Mitch McConnell. I mean, here's a guy who actually I thought might have somehow saved some grace by standing up and calling Donald Trump out after January 6th. And then just, you know, a few months later, despite Trump's attacking not only him, but his wife in a personal way, which was just horrible as far as I'm concerned, to see Mitch McConnell stand up and sort of shuffle through an endorsement of Donald Trump just to sort of, I don't know, hold on to some sense of power in the Senate was just, to me, he's now lower than Lindsey Graham, and I don't think I would ever say that on this program.
He's stepping down, but he's staying until 2027. Right. Just go home.
Well, he may ultimately leave. I mean, it depends. Mine is an outrage about gun violence, in particular gun violence against women. We just had a domestic violence kind of shooting, a couple of them, one in New Hampshire, one in Boston. We have too many guns and too many violent offenders who are not prosecuted. I applaud the Rhode Island Coalition Against Gun Violence for really pushing the state legislature on gun safety, not removing people's guns, not banning people's guns. In that respect, gun safety. They're also pushing for an assault weapon ban. They're going to gather on Wednesday, I think, next week at the State House for hearings. And kudos to the legislature for doing the hearings. I can understand the word ban. People don't like it. But you can still do things to make it safer in a society that has too many guns.
This week, the Washington Bridge, we should be getting the report. Director Peter Alviti, the DOT director, says that the report on what to do, I think we all know it's going to be a fairly major rebuild, if not a replacement. Alan, one of those discussions we had as we were waiting for Bill to come in traffic through the Washington
Washington Bridge.
Bill calls every week at some panels. So I'm really sorry.
I'm now the new expert on the Washington Bridge.
Bill goes, I haven't been driven on 95 in 10 years. It's a wake-up call. We were talking about healthcare workers.
Yeah.
And the talk about the intersection of healthcare and transportation, and we've talked about economy, and that if you're tired of getting to Rhode Island Hospital, maybe you go to work in Massachusetts.
Yeah, my wife hears it every day when she's there. You know, a lot of her colleagues, a lot of those professionals that have to add at least an hour commute time in, and then going
to
back
a stressful job.
To a stressful job, you know, with rates, reimbursement rates with a higher pay in Massachusetts, you might have, you know, many healthcare workers saying, I'm done with this craziness, you know, because I can't flex time it because it's a different type of, you know, work environment. So I might as well go maybe Fall River, Massachusetts, Boston, where I can get higher paid, not have to deal with this crazy stress of sitting in traffic for at least an hour each way.
We haven't had you on since right after it closed, and a lot has gone on. What's your 30,000 view on what's going on?
I'm looking at the politics of it, and people never forget that they're sitting in traffic, and they get angrier and angrier, and I don't understand the governor's response. He should treat it as like a huge crisis facing the state and be out there every single day in some way, shape, or form talking about it. I don't know how Peter Alvey still has his job. He did a pretty good job under Gina trying to fix a lot of bridges and roads, but now this is a colossal mistake. It's oversight. It's the way DOT has been run, and he has to go. And unless McKee decides that and makes that happen by this summer, I think he becomes the biggest liability for Governor Key going into 2026.
Where does the governor live? Where does the governor live?
He does not live in the East Bay.
He's in Cumberland. Right. I think you have to sit in that traffic 5 days a week to fully appreciate it. Just as you had the experience this morning, and you live in Pawtucket.
Just compare it to what Gina would have done. Gina would have been out there all the time, and whether it was on her watch or not, it's just a big contrast, and he's got to show that this is the most important thing. These are people whose lives are really negatively impacted.
Yeah, I mean, I can't sit here and say anything good about the Washington Bridge, obviously. I mean, it's certainly not a problem, I don't think, that occurred overnight. So I think, obviously, it's been coming for a long time, and maybe someone should have known.
So you're pardoning Gina?
Maybe someone should have known.
Are you going to pinpoint it to two Republican
I think
governors
if you look at
years
when,
ago? Did it begin
you look
with
at when
Lincoln?
Governor Kacheri was there. You know, I don't know what
they were doing. Wow! Really go way back!
Sleeping the switch.
But look, when these, right, it's a huge problem, and messaging in our business or in the political business is critical, and the messaging hasn't been as good as certainly as it could have been, and there's still room for improvement. It's a bad situation. I mean, it impacts a lot of people. I used to go over that bridge sometimes 5 or 10 times a day. I'm glad it didn't fall into the river, but I think that there was a slow recognition, I think, across the board, not just with the governor, but with a lot of people, at how severe this was and how negatively it was going to impact such a huge number of people. And now people have kind of come to grips with that, and we're not out of it yet. That's the other biggest problem is that I think that
we're just,
you know,
beginning. It'll be at least 2 years to fix this bridge, and maybe 100 million,
more,
maybe 300
more,
million.
More.
And, you know, these people are going to be living this, and they're every time they live it, they're going to think, how did this happen, and who am I going to blame?
So it spills into the 26th governor's
absolutely,
cycle.
Because, yeah. Look, all politics is local, and this is going to have an impact. For mayors, it's plowing or trash. For the governor, infrastructure and transportation is going to be big.
Sorry, I got to hold you there, folks. It is a quick 30 minutes, particularly with this panel. Bill and Alan and Wendy, no truth of the rumor we brought in extra oxygen for this show. Come back next week. We always have a lot going on at the height of the General Assembly session. We will have a full recap and analysis next week as the Lively Experiment continues.
The Lively Experiment is generously underwritten by...
Hi, I'm John Hazen-White, Jr. For over 30 years, a Lively Experiment has provided insight and analysis of the political issues that face Rhode Islanders. I'm a proud supporter of this great program and Rhode Island PBS.